This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February 22, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. I'm going to be talking to you this week about all the little things that have come up this week in the area of federal taxes. And we're going to start this week by taking a look at some of the more recent things that have gone on, starting at this point with a notice that came in with private letter ruling 2016-07004. This particular ruling deals with a payment by an organization to customers of a utility for installing photovoltaic equipment. The organization provided those payments to consumers who had decided to install that equipment. If they installed the equipment, then the consumer would get a payment from this organization. Now, this particular payment that the consumer got, the question arose, was it going to be considered income or not? As part of the ruling, we found out a little bit about the program. One of the things we discovered on this program was that the organization in this case only approved equipment no larger than was reasonably expected to generate electricity needed. It appears from the ruling that we got that there was still an installation in there, that if there was excess capacity, it would in essence go back on the grid. But the idea was that on average, this would generate just about the electricity that the organization needed. And conceptually, the idea being that effectively there'd be a net of zero that would come to or from the utility. And that's how we would structure this particular deal if you agreed to install this equipment. So the organization would provide this payment. Now, the question became, of course, normally we know under the Internal Revenue Code, Code Section 61 tells us that income from any source essentially is initially part of gross income. However, there is a special provision in Section 136A that provides that if, in fact, you receive a subsidy for energy conservation, that those subsidies paid by the insurance, and it's a direct or indirect subsidy provided by a public utility for costs related to the purchase or installation of energy conservation measures, that's considered to simply reduce the basis of the asset that you receive, but it does not end up creating taxable income to you. So the question becomes, is this subsidy paid by an organization that was not the utility going to be considered to be a subsidy that was excludable, or was it going to be considered to be income to the taxpayer? Because, you know, they basically got photovoltaic equipment installed on their installed without having to pay the full cost of it. So they basically, you know, got something worth more than what they paid for. Well, the IRS decided in this case that it still amounted to an indirect subsidy. And as it was an indirect subsidy, it was considered to be not income. Some of you may remember a case that came back or a ruling that came back a few years ago, and you might be a little confused at this one because you looked at it. You might decide that this is a different result than we found in private letter ruling 2010-35003. And especially those of you in Arizona remember this one because Arizona was the particular situation we were looking at here. And in that case, the IRS ruled that the payment from the utility to the customer was considered to be gross income. You might wonder, well, what's the difference in the two? Well, there's a couple of things going on here. First, in the original 2010 ruling, the taxpayers in question were going to qualify for an energy credit. The question quickly became, was the energy credit they could receive on that basis? Because remember, if this is a subsidy, we reduce the basis of the asset. If you reduce the basis of the asset, you reduce the basis available for claiming an energy credit for installing this equipment. And if that's what happens to you, then obviously, if your tax rate is less than the credit rate, you're actually being hurt because it's better if your tax rate is higher than the credit rate or tax rate's lower than the credit rate, then it's better to pick it up as income, but then take a credit for a larger amount. So we increase your taxes, but give you a larger credit. And that was clearly what the idea was back in the 2010 ruling. Now, there are some differences between those rulings. You know, it's just one of those things. In this case, one of the key differences was these taxpayers did not retain any rights to any credits. That was a key part of the program. They couldn't get any benefits aside from the subsidy. So the key problem there was, since they lost all rights to credits, the credit issue for basis wasn't at play here. So there was certainly a bias to want the other answer, because if it was taxable income, it would have cost them. The other thing that may have been a difference, which the ruling did mention, was that in this case, in the Arizona case, the concept was that they were going to be selling back to the utility. And in fact, that's what they said. It was a payment for selling the electricity back to the utility. In this case, it was structured so that there was, should be no effective sale back to the utility. There was nothing. The net to the utility and from the utility would work out to be no more, no greater than zero, or the utility would be providing electricity to this organization. So that's the difference. Of course, fundamentally, if you're a little bit cynical, you might decide that the real difference was that in the two cases, they asked for different answers and the IRS went along with the request in both cases. In any event, if you have these types of payments, you might want to take a look at 2016-07-004. And if you have a program like this, compare it to 2010-35-003. Depending on your taxpayer situation, the structure of the program, you might try to figure out which one of those two programs, the program you're looking at, looks more like. Next up, we have a case where you ever had a client that went and got the wrong checkbook? They have multiple organizations, they do multiple entities, and they end up paying something out of the wrong checkbook. Well, in the case of Green versus United States, 117 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2016-418, which is a district court case from the Western District of Oklahoma, case number CIV 13-1237D, issued on February of the 10th of 2016, we have that particular problem. A payment got made from the wrong account. In this particular case, it was a charitable contribution. It was meant to be made by a partnership. And the actual taxpayer in this case had a 99% interest in that partnership. So it was meant to be paid by the partnership. But instead, it was paid by a related corporation. Okay, that's, you know, that's kind of a problem. Because, of course, here's the hitch. There are many differences. We know there are wild differences in when a charitable contribution is allowed, and especially in the percentage limitations allowed to a charitable, to an organization that makes a charitable contribution. For instance, trusts have effectively no limitation on the percent of income that can be taken as a charitable deduction. They have a bunch of other special rules that may make a charitable contribution more interesting to get, but once they get it, it's 100%. The flip side of that is, if you look at a C corporation, you're down to 10%. And if it's an S corporation, well, okay, that's fine. There is no such limitation. It passes through to whoever. But the problem there is that an S corporation, you have to have basis to take the pass through. Obviously, we need that in a partnership too, but it's easier to have basis in a partnership than an S corporation. So obviously, it could be very significant which entity made the charitable contribution. There was no question. And by the way, the contributions in question were essentially, they had paid a total of $7.5 million in contributions. Now, not all of those were involved with the wrong checkbook, but a fairly significant chunk of them were. So this was not a small amount of contributions. The partnership did, when it was discovered that the check had been issued from the wrong organization. The partnership in this case has audited financial statements. Those audited financial statements reflected this as a charitable contribution of the partnership, and the partnership actually reimbursed the corporation for the charitable contribution. Now, the IRS said, well, that's all well and good, but sorry, guys, you can't assign a deduction to another party. The partnership, you know, basically the corporation made the charitable contribution. That's who has to claim it. And if it's going to be, you know, effectively unusable or virtually unusable due to the 10% of income limitation, well, that's just tough luck, guys. The court in this case wasn't quite so harsh. In fact, wasn't harsh at all in this case. It found that the partnership was actually entitled to the deduction under this situation. It found that it intended to make the contribution. It was not using hindsight to figure out where was the better place to take it. And the court also, kind of interestingly, though, in this case, seemed to indicate that the fact that it was a charitable contribution as opposed to other types of deductions might also have been significant, claiming that this deduction is a social policy deduction, not a deduction born of legislative grace. That would have been a trade or business deduction. In any event, a couple of things to look at here. First thing I would suggest is, A, obviously, if your client does foul up, you want to take a look and look at this and see if you can try to argue with the agent that your client was, you know, essentially like this case, like the Green case. Number two, though, the better thing to do if you can is try to ensure your clients don't fell up like this. It's much better not to ever have the argument than to have to try to make an argument based on this case. So be aware that we have to look at that. It should be important when you have multiple entities, like in this case, you have a closely held corporation, you have a partnership that is as mainly owned by a trust, is being used, it would what would assume, we don't know for sure, but it seems highly likely being used somewhat for estate planning, etc. You got to make sure that people understand where things should take place and that getting the right checkbook is not just a nice thing, it may be a crucial thing. Certainly, it's not unusual to see the IRS on exam if a client does get the wrong checkbook problem, to see the IRS try to insist that, sorry, it's got to stay with wherever it was paid, and tough luck. So be aware, while Green gives us a way out, if a client has fouled up, it's probably far more important to try to tell your clients to attempt not to actually foul up in the first place. Next is Chief Counsel Advice 2016-07-026, issued on February the 12th. This deals with some incentive payments under Medicare. In this case, an organization participated in a program that would pay it incentives for what were called shared savings under Medicare for entities in fee-for-service arrangements with Medicare. Now, this took a look at the overall cost of care on a group of patients that would be assigned to them, that, you know, part, some of their patients would be carved out to be part of this. The federal government would pick that carve out, is apparently from this program, and the federal government established various standards. But if the cost of caring for these people was held below certain limitations for the year, then these guys would get extra money that would be paid to them. So the concept was they would look at the overall health. The nature of the program was such, though, that it wasn't just what this provider charged, but it was all the providers that Medicare paid, because they were looking at the overall ability of this organization to manage the patient's health, was the argument that was being made. And because of that, it depended on issues that this organization had no idea what the numbers would be. So here's the catch. We're coming to the end of the year. You earn this based on the year, but you have no idea what the numbers are. And in fact, CMS doesn't know what the numbers are. Some of those things won't be resolved for a few months into the next year. The question became, what's the proper taxable year to report this? It definitely was earned for cost during this year. So in one sense, you might think, well, you know, it's earned for what we bill in 2015. It must be, if we're an accrual basis taxpayer, it's got to be 2015 income. But the IRS said, you know, you need to take a look at the rules here. An accrual basis taxpayer essentially recognizes income when all events have taken place to establish the taxpayer's rights to the income, and the amount of income can be determined with reasonable certainty. When both of those are true, the first year for which both of those are true, you record the income. The IRS, in this case, the national office, and this, of course, was being referred up from an agent in the field who wanted to tax it in 2015. The national office said, in this particular case, there are too many variables that are unknown at year end. For that reason, the all events test has not been met. They did not have a fixed right to receive income at the end of the year, nor could that amount be reasonably estimated. The test here being to see if the taxpayer could record it. Rather, the taxpayer needs to record this income in the year in which it is paid. This ruling is useful from a couple of standpoints. First, obviously, if you're working with a taxpayer who is in this program and is getting payments under it, this tells you the national office's view, at least, when looking at these facts as to when the proper year to record was. But secondly, it's a useful review of the rules for accrual basis taxpayers. Please remember that the rules for revenue recognition under taxes will not necessarily be the rules for revenue recognition under GAAP. So you have to understand the rules, especially now that we have FASB changing those rules for revenue recognitions under GAAP. You know, we have that particular program in place, you know, that's coming in and will be phased in. It'll be coming in here shortly. You have to understand the rule. The catch is here to meet the two phases of the all events test. When you do that, you recognize the income. In this case, the taxpayer, you know, was unable, could show that essentially not only was there no fixed right at that point in time, because there were still events the next year that would impact what was considered to be their cost of care for the period in question. But secondly, it simply wasn't knowable. There was no way to reasonably estimate at the end of the year. For that reason, it would be deferred until the year in which it was paid. Next up, we have a case here of Berkshire 2006-5 LLP versus Commissioner. And the case of this particular case is Tax Court Memo Decision 2016-25, issued on February 17th. The problem in this case related to a partnership, and actually what's happening here, so you understand our starting point here. The real problem we have here was a petition was filed one day, literally one day late with the tax court. Somebody couldn't count. This was a partnership in question, and it's a partnership that was subject to the not soon, because it's not till 2018 tax years, and then until we get to exams on those years, but let's phrase it eventually to be removed, TEFRA audit rules for partnerships. And this particular partnership was taxed under the TEFRA rules. In the TEFRA rules, when we get to the end, we get a final partnership administrative adjustment issued to the partnership. It is issued to the tax matters partner and issued within 60 days after the original notice is given to the TMP. It's given to any partners that are notice partners. That's those where the IRS has been told about the partners in question. This deals with one of the notice partners. And it doesn't deal with the tax matters partner for a fairly simple rule. The tax matters partner was actually been dissolved back in 2009. And this was the actual final partnership administrative adjustment was issued in 2014. It was dissolved because it turns out the SEC charged the principals with fraud, and the state of Wisconsin administratively dissolved the partnership that had been the TMP. So effectively, the TMP was gone, disappeared in 2009. The partnership never informed the IRS of a new address to send notices to, nor did they inform the IRS of any change in a TMP. So when the time came to issue the notice, what the IRS did in this case, they totally disallowed all of the intangible drilling costs. We do discover later that the taxpayer wanted to raise what they wanted to raise if they got to tax court, was that there should have been a theft loss. So we're going to assume that maybe our problem here was that the intangible drilling costs may not have actually been paid. Because if I'm going to argue it's a theft, I'm going to presume that we're arguing that essentially they took the money. And they might have took it without ever paying for the cost. That would explain why the IRS might not want to allow intangible drilling costs. In any event, the IRS sent 9 different copies of the notice. There were 3, and 3 of those notices that went out, they had 3 different addresses for the partnership. So they sent it to each, they sent notices to the 3 different addresses, and they sent it to the addresses of the various parties in this case, the partners, all these tax matters partners, et cetera. So there were 9 notices. 3 of the notices were sent out to just addressed to the tax matters partner, care of the partnership. Within the 60-day period, they issued the notice to the notice partner, and one of the notice partners in this case received the notice. Now, he decides he wants to challenge. Under the TEFRA rules, if the tax matters partner does not file the notice, so in this case, again, remember, we have 2014 filing. We send the 9 FPAAs. They go out to us. The notice partner, any notice partner can file a petition with the tax court on behalf of the partnership within 60 days after the 90-day period for the partnership's filing goes away. So that's 150 days after the original FPAA notice, we have to file a petition with the tax court. In this particular case, they filed it on the 151st day. Okay, that's a problem. So to solve that problem, they decided to try to claim that, well, since the FPAA had been dissolved, in fact, the tax matters partner had been dissolved, there could be no valid FPAA. The tax court said, nice try, but no good. It does not matter if the tax matters partner is dissolved, gone, whatever. The partnership must notify the IRS of any new person to notify and new addresses. Secondly, the court noted that it had been held multiple times that it is perfectly acceptable for the IRS to simply mail a notice to the tax matters partner care of the partnership. That's good enough for this purpose. You know, that's what they did. So they did what they had to do. Also, it notes, and it's interesting aside, remember, the standard last known address rules do not apply to TIF for partnerships. Rather, the partnership must give specific notice to the IRS about the any address change that takes place independent of any notice given otherwise. So that's also important to note. In any event, the court noted, the IRS gave proper notice. As well, the court pointed out, the notice partner got his notice within 60 days after the FPAA had been issued. He actually received it. So he had essentially 90 days to prepare his petition. Somebody just apparently lost count, we'll have to assume, because filing it exactly one day late most likely means somebody had a mistake on the calendar as to what they thought the date was when it had to be filed, because that's a little bit odd to miss it by one. And in any event, that happens. So the tax court said, sorry, guy, you can't raise your argument that this should be a theft loss. Whether or not that's a proper justification for the partnership, whether or not that's how it should have been handled, is irrelevant at this point because your time, the tax court's not able to hear your petition on this matter. What that tells you is, remember, these little details, and you know, it's kind of interesting. Number one, it's a good thing to look at for the TIFRA partnership rules to remember how those work, especially if you have a client who's an investor in something where there was a situation, let's say a fraud or some problem where the promoting partner, the promoters are kind of gone now, the partnership's still around. Remember, that partnership can still be examined, notices can still come out. And we have problems there, so that can be issues. We've had a couple of those cases where we've had TMPs that have had problems, shall we say, that rendered them somewhat questionable going down the line. Secondly, remember those days for the tax court. As the tax court points out, if you miss something by one day going to tax court, they simply lose jurisdiction. They can't yank it back under virtually any other means, any equitable type means. So you've got to make sure you meet deadlines in this requirements. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of February 22nd, 2016. Be sure to join us in the future and also go to the website. We've got our website there at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On the website, we post information related to developments that occur during the week in taxes, as well as updates of things that happen during that week. You'll find all of the links to the various source documents that we've discussed this week, as well as information relating to, you know, the kind of discussion we're going to have about what they mean. So you want to look at the documents, you want to read more on the discussion, be sure you go there. And as I say, be sure to join us next week. Coming back here, we'll talk again about the developments here in the area of federal taxes.